You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at Schwabius.com.
Englishman David Hobbs, or Hobbo to his friends and fans, is one of motor racing's most remarkable all-rounders. In a 41-year driving career, he's raced in almost every imaginable category. Endurance sports cars, touring cars, Formula One, Formula 5000, Indy cars, Trans Am, Can-Am, and even NASCAR. He has done the lot. And on top of that, he's been a television commentator in America for nearly 40 years, bringing wit and wisdom to the screen as part of NBC's Formula One team. It's all been put together in a book, Hobbo, Motor Racer, Motor Mouth, the autobiography of David Hobbs. And I'm delighted to say the great man himself is on the line to me right now. David, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Giles. Nice to speak to you.
Good to have you with us. It's been a fascinating career. You seem to have done the lot. When did it all start?
Well, I guess it all started when a friend of mine got his motorbike. And I couldn't believe the way he just rode off on his bike, and that sort of changed my whole mindset. And so I got a motorbike too, and then a couple of years after that, I raced my mum's Mollis Oxford at a place called Snetterton in England, and that's what it all started. The engine blew, and we had to get a lift home, me and my friend who had gone, Tony Barrett. And I should have realised then that it was a fruitless career, but anyway, I kept on going, and here we are, 60 years later, still sort of involved.
So from then on, from that sort of point, I mean, how did you explain it to the, to your family that you'd actually blown the motor on the car, and when did you decide to start taking this whole motor racing lark somewhat seriously?
Well, I raced Mum's car for a year with some minor success, and then the next year I was determined to race Dad's Jag. And the very first race with that, I turned it over at Alton Park, which is a little bit unfortunate. Not quite how it had gone to plan.
Right.
And I'd been racing it on Michelin X tyres because I was a complete novice. You know, I had to, really, considering I'd been an engineering apprentice for 5 years, I should have known more about it. But anyway, I didn't. And I put his car together again with a friend from Jag, and it looked a bit of a mess from then on. But it became quite potent because I put some disc brakes on it. It was a 1955 car, so it had drums. Put disc brakes on it and put a better cylinder head on it, and then I won some races in that. And of course, both these cars were fitted with my dad's automatic transmission. And then the year after that, his firm, Westinghouse Brake and Signal, took an interest in his firm, and they all decided that maybe to advertise the gearbox, I should race a proper car. So instead of driving to and from the races in the race car, we actually bought a Lotus Elite, put the gearbox in it, and I raced that in 1961. And we did have a lot of success in that. We got off to a bit of a dodgy start, but then with a chap called Ben Cox and a chap called Henry Lee from Lotus, who came in to help, then we started to have some wins. And our first big win came fairly on. We went to the Nürburgring 1,000 kilometres in Germany, me and my friend Bill Pinckney, and when we got there, we were protested out of our rightful class by one of our competitors.
And, right.
which was the 1100cc GT class, and we've got put up to the 1600cc sports car class, in which we had absolutely no hope at all. Well, luckily, there weren't many entrants in that, and the last one dropped out on the last lap, and we won it. And being Germany, they're very methodical, we won about 10 times the prize money, so that was good.
Excellent.
Was a good protest.
How old were you when you went to the ring, and what was it like going out for that first lap on that first day? Because it is the most daunting circuit even now, and then it must have been absolutely even more so.
Well, it was daunting in more ways than one, you know, when we got there, because, of course, the pits, which had been built pre-war when they built the circuit, were like an old, you know, a big old stable yard, a bit like something out of Young Frankenstein, you know, great big cobbled paddock and all these dark, dingy sort of stables around there, and it was like an old stable yard. And, of course, the Nürburgring, it's all very forested country with the Schloss right on top of the hill overlooking everything. It all looked very medieval. And But of course, I'd heard so much about the track, and you're right. I mean, you go out the first time round, and you just can't believe it. Yeah, 175 corners, which I knew there was going to be 175 corners, but I didn't realise it was going to be so hilly.
Right.
So every corner's either going up or going down a hill or on the top of a hill or at the bottom of a hill. And it was a hell of a challenge, but Bill and I both stepped up to the plate fairly quickly, and we learnt it pretty well, and we were doing very, very representative lap times. It's only, you know, of course, obviously, being 14, nearly 15 miles long, you can't just, you go around all day and you still only do 10 laps. So you only get 10 goes at each corner.
Yeah.
So I can't remember how many laps we did, but we probably only did about 6 or 7 practice laps each.
And from that, you went on. How did the... Because you've got a very strong connection with America, and I noticed in the notes that on the first race you took part in was in what was then the Daytona 3-hour and is now the 24-hour. So where did the connection with the States come?
Well, actually, you're right. My very first real professional race was after I'd finished my apprenticeship at JAG. The managing director by then was a chap called Lofty England. And Lofty England had masterminded Jaguar's wins with the C and D type at Le Mans in the 50s, and by then he'd gone from being competition manager to managing director. And I was racing, first of all, the Jag when I was an apprentice there, and then the Elite. And luckily for me, he was my boss. He was everybody's boss because he was the managing director of the whole firm. But he quite liked my racing style, and he helped me. And when I finished my apprenticeship in 1961, I married my girlfriend, Margaret Young, who is the sister of somebody that lives in your neck of the woods, Paul Young, who lives just down the road in Marbella.
He does indeed, yes.
And I married her in 61, left Jag, and Lofty had got me a drive with a private team who owned Jaguars. And his first race that he decided to do was the very first race at Daytona, a road race. Bill France, who ran Daytona, was very keen to internationalize the circuit. And so I went off to do the 3-hour. And then I didn't go back to the States. That was in 1962. I went back in 64 with Lotus and did a couple of races. But my first serious attempt there was 1969 when John Surtees sent me over in a Formula 5000 car. And I went to do the Formula 5000 series.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the Formula 5000 a little bit later on, because I know you've got a great affinity with that itself. You also, 62 was the year that you first went to Le Mans, a race that you would do on several occasions. That must have been a tremendous experience as well, your first race as well.
Oh, my God. Le Mans, because when I was a kid, I mean, obviously, we all looked up to the Formula 1 drivers, but really the race I wanted to do and I wanted to win was Le Mans. And, my first race there in 62... I drove a Lotus Elite, not my Lotus Elite, just a regular one, and I drove with an Australian called Frank Gardner, and we drove for the Lotus Team Elite, and it was all I had expected and more. It was just a wonderful track to drive on, all just streets, you know, roads, 8.5 mile lap, the straight was 4.5 miles long, some great turns, of course, in the Elite, practically everything was flat out, including going... Because it's straight, you get wound up, you'd be flat out, and you'd only gone about 300 yards down the road, you've got another 4 miles to go. You know, things like Ferrari, you know, Testarossa's passing you, you know, with a 100-mile-an-hour difference. So that was a bit daunting. You have to keep your eye on the mirror. But And in fact, it was one of my most successful. I did Le Mans 20 times in all. And that first one was one of my most successful. Won the class, won the index of thermal efficiency, came eighth overall. So I got off to a great start. I wish I could have carried that terrific finish on through some of my other visits to Le Mans.
But you did do Le Mans 20 times, and that's not to be sniffed at. You mentioned that you were driving with Frank Gardner. I spoke with Nick Faure a couple of weeks ago, and he said that driving with Frank Gardner was an experience because he was just such a great character.
Oh, my God. Frank Gardner was the king of the one-liners. You know, Aussies are all very, very funny, and Frank, he was a good bit older than me, and he just had so many great one-liners about the car and the people and France and the hotel where we were staying. And, I never raced with Frank again, but I did race against Frank many, many times after that. And then in the very early 80s, Frank had retired and gone back to Australia, and he was the manager, motorsports manager for BMW Australia. And he asked me out there, and I drove in the Bathurst 1000 a couple of times in the BMW where Frank had got me a drive. So, I continued to work with Frank for, over 20 years, of course, from when we first drove together at Le Mans.
You also dabbled in F1. Now, you're best known as a sports car driver and if you like an F Formula 5000 driver. But, your F1 career, you got involved with... who did you originally... Because you were involved with Honda, weren't you, in F1? But
Well, I drove a little bit for everybody. I wanted to be a Formula 1 driver, obviously, and I wanted to be the world champion. Because when I look back on it now, I always thought my racing luck was pretty appalling. But obviously, I'm very lucky to be even alive today, because maybe if I'd gone into Formula 1 when I wanted to, I probably wouldn't be talking to you now. I'd probably be dead. Because, about 40% of the drivers I started with were killed. The very first race I had was with Tim Parnell, and we went to Syracuse in Italy, which again was another public street circuit which went through the town of Syracuse. And I can't remember how long the lap was, 6 or 7 miles, and it was all just streets and roads. And the crowd were right on the edge of the road, and I mean right on the edge of the road. And as the race progressed, got near the end, the crowd got nearer and nearer the track, so eventually, you're whistling through a gap that's only just a bit wider than the car. Now it's a little bit nerve-wracking because you didn't want to kill anybody, especially in Sicily, because you just knew that you'd get lynched if you did. So, and I came third behind the two factory Ferraris of Surtees and Bandini, and I really thought that had put me on the map, and I kind of made the fatal mistake of waiting for the phone to ring instead of picking it up myself. So that sort of didn't lead to much. And I drove in the British Grand Prix the following year in a BRM. And I drove in the very first Canadian Grand Prix in 1967. And then I drove a Honda V12 in the Italian Grand Prix in 1968. And that had been arranged by John Surtees, who I had quite a long relationship with. And that race was supposed to morph into driving for Honda full-time in 1969 in their Formula 1 team. Well, unfortunately, at the end of the year, 68, they pulled out because they decided to concentrate on using all their best engineers to develop low-emission engines for the US market, which they had yet to try and conquer. And so they dropped out for a few years there before coming back, obviously, with much success with people like Senna, with Williams and McLaren.
But you found your niche because you went over to drive for for John Wyer's legendary golf team and with the Ford GT40s.
Well, that was, I drove a race at Montlhéry in a Lola T70. Montlhéry was a track outside France which had a bit of banking, a bit like Brooklands. It was a parabolic banking, not straight banking. And I put it on the pole. There were a couple of GT40s in the race. But my co-driver was a bit of an amateur, and he owned the car, and anyway, we dropped out. But at the end of the day, very soon after that, I got a call from David York, who was the team manager for Golf and Wire, and said, look, I know you've been driving for John Surtees in his Lola T70s and his Formula 5000, and we're looking for a driver to add to our Golf team for next year. So I signed up to drive for them. And that was my first really big team, Golf and John Wire. John Wire, of course, one of the absolutely legendary team managers, team owners of all time in long distance racing. So to drive for them was a bit of a feather in my cap, and also pretty successful. So a great team to drive for.
And who were the other team drivers in the team on his roster at that time, and what was he like to drive for?
Well, I drove with Paul Hawkins, who was another Australian in the ilk of Frank Gardner. Short, stocky guy, but very quick. And the other car was driven by Jackie Ickx, who was obviously the number one driver in the team, and Brian Redman. So it was a pretty strong pairing, quartet. And we had some good results. I mean, they won the World Sports Car Championship with that car, with the team in 68. I had one win. Me and Paul had one. We should have had two, but they wanted Ickx to win, and we had a lap lead on Jackie Ickx, and they made us slow down and wait for him to catch up again, which I felt a bit pissed off at the time, because, the driver's points didn't matter, really. It was just where the car finished, and we would finish first and second, whatever happened. And then, of course, they asked me to drive the next year, 69, same thing, but Paul left to set up his own team, and, in fact, unfortunately, that year, he was killed in one of his own cars at Alton Park. And for that second year, I drove with Mike Hailwood. And he and I had become very good friends in South Africa in 1966. And so it was great to have him with me in the seat. You know, so the two of us drove for Gulf in 69.
You went over to the States. F1 didn't work out, but F5000 did. And for those who don't know, tell us a little bit. There was a Goodwood members meeting, I think it was last weekend, which had some of those cars out, and they sounded absolutely superb. I was following it via the live streaming, which you now can get. But explain a little bit about Formula 5000 and how successful you were with that.
Well, Formula 5000 was started in the States, and they called it Formula A. And it was a single-seater race car with a 5-litre engine, V8. And, of course, so you got the choice of, you could get a Chevrolet or Ford or a Dodge. You know, they all made 5-litre V8s for street cars. And so they were a production stop-block engine in a chassis. And once it became popular in the States and over here, all the manufacturers, March and Lola, McLaren, all built Formula 5000 cars, and they became very sophisticated and very fast in a very quick rate of knots. The first 5000 race here in England was in 1969, and I was on the pole at Alton Park in John Surtees' TS5 5000, and alongside me was Peter Gethin in the Church Farm Racing McLaren M10A. He went on to win the race, because as the race progressed, my car kept bottoming more and more and more and more, and then I finally had to pull in, and the front wishbones hadn't snapped, but they'd just bent. So gradually lowered the car to the ground, which wasn't really perfect. And then that was in, I don't know, that would be in April probably. And then in June, I went over to Ireland, and Mike was driving somebody else's Lola, and I was driving the Surtees, and I won the race at Mondello Park, just outside Dublin Tor.
That must have been quite an occasion.
It was a hell of an occasion. And afterwards in the bar, we're all drinking away, and Mags is there, and Mike and Pauline, and we're drinking away, and the barman comes and says, "Okay, lads, drink up. Closing time's coming up, closing time, come out and drink." I said to him, "I didn't think you had closing time." And, "Oh, yes, sir, very, very sure, yes, sir, absolutely." So as we were all shambling towards the door, same barman says, where are you going? And we said, "Well, you know, time's up, so we got to leave." You said, "We got to leave." "Oh, no," he said. No. He said, "In 5 minutes, it'll be midnight. And then when it's midnight, it'll be Monday morning, and we can start again." So we had a good night that night. And then very soon after that, Surtees sent me to America. And that really began my major relationship with America. I raced at Road America. My very first race was at Road America in America, which is in Wisconsin, up near Elkhart Lake. And I went back and I raced at Elkhart Lake at least twice a year from 1969 until 1986. And so America became where I did most. I still raced in Europe, still did Le Mans, still did, Nürburgring and other races like that. But America became my main kind of hunting ground, even though we still lived in England.
And also, you did the most famous, you could argue, the most famous race of them all, or at least the most famous race in the States, of course, the Indy 500.
Yeah, I think you're right the first time. It probably is the most famous race in the world. Well, that and Le Mans got to be the first, the most two famous races. And, I went there with Roger Penske the first year, and the gearbox broke, and which caused a crash. The guy behind me ran into me when I slowed up. And then I went back in 1973, and the engine stopped in the middle of the race, and then we got to start again and finished 10th. But the year after that, I came 5th for McLaren in a factory McLaren, and Johnny Rutherford, who was driving the other car, went on and had a win. So that was a pretty good... I did it one more time. I should have probably done it more, really, but my heart was set on road racing, and I was still doing the Formula 5000, and that first year I went with John Surtees. We only did half the races, and I missed the championship by 1 point. The guy that won the championship won 1 out of 14 races. I won 3 out of my 7, but I just missed out by 1 point on the championship. And the second year, we were late again, and I came 3rd in the championship. And then the third time I went back was when I was driving for Roger at Indy, and also in that Ferrari 512. And so to drive for him, I had to change from Firestone to Goodyear tyres. So I left John Surtees and went to drive for a guy called Carl Hogan, and we won the championship easy, 5 out of 8 races. So, I won more Formula 5000 races than anybody, but not the aforementioned, but Mr. Brian Redman, another transplant Englishman, and he went on to win the championship 3 times, and he won a lot of races, but I'm next on the race tally win.
What is it like? I mean, because one of the things that is the adaptability, and I suppose it was a thing of the time as well, you know, from the 50s, you talked about racing for Lofty England, and then racing in the 60s and the 70s, and people were leaping into all sorts of cars, even in the same race meeting, you know, this is the Easter weekend, and you'd be at Alton Park, and Jim Clark would be racing in 3 or 4 races. Do you think your style meant that you could leap in and out of any car, be it single-seater, long-distance, or sprint?
Well, I think that most, you know, any good race driver is a good race driver. You put him in anything, he can do well. But it has become so much more specialised, which is a shame, really, because, as you say, I mean, you used to go to Silverstone very early in my career, and you'd watch Jimmy Clark, and he'd race in the Formula 1 race, he'd race in the Formula 2 race, he'd race in a sports car race in a Lotus 23, and he'd probably drive a Lotus Cortina in the saloon car race. I mean, he might race 4 times in the same day. Nowadays, A, they won't let you do that if you're driving the Formula 1 car, and B, nobody seems to want to do it. Everybody does specialise. So you get saloon car drivers, you get sports car drivers, you get Formula 1 drivers, you get NASCAR drivers, you get IndyCar drivers, and very few people. It was great to see Nico Hülkenberg, for instance, win Le Mans, 3 years ago when he's regularly driving Formula 1. And it's also good to see Fernando Alonso this year break out from the mould, and of course when you're a 2-time world champion and you're driving for a team like McLaren, which at the moment is struggling, he's got the power to say, no, I'm going to drive, and he's driving for Toyota in the World Endurance Championship as well, so it's good to see that. But I mean, I suppose the most adaptable of all was Mario Andretti, who won the World Championship for Lotus in 1978, and at the same time he was doing IndyCar, including with the front-engined offset cars racing on dirt. So he might be racing on dirt with a front-engine car with offset suspension and bigger rear tyre on the right than on the left and all this sort of stuff. And then the next week, he'd go to Spa in the most sophisticated race car of the time and not only win the race, but go on to win the world championship. So that is really, really, really showing your abilities at all end of the spectrum of driving.
What attracted you to getting behind the mic when you stepped out from behind the wheel and become a pundit and a commentator?
Well, I was always a bit of a motor mouth, and I always gave good answers when I was, you know, being interviewed for telly or radio or newspapers and whatever. And me and a guy called Sam Posey, who wrote the foreword for my book, he and I were chosen by Rod Campbell, who was the PR of the L&M Formula 5000 Championship in 71, 2, 3, and 4. And he used us pretty much exclusively to publicise the races. And then Sam retired early, and he went almost straight away to ABC. I got asked by CBS to work for them in 1976. So, you know, I started doing commentary for them in 76, and I worked for them until 1995. And I also worked for ESPN as well, because at that time, when I asked CBS if I could do some stuff on ESPN, they said, sure. Because at the time, everybody thought those cables would... cable TVs would just, you know, be flashing the pan.
Right.
So I was working for CBS, ESPN. And then I got, I left both those and went to work for a new channel called Speed Channel, which turned into Speed. Then it got taken over by Fox and became just Speed. And they started doing Formula One as well. I'd done Formula One on CBS and ESPN. And so I've basically been doing Formula One, one way or another, for nearly, you know, for almost 40 years now. So then Fox lost the Formula One contract to NBC 5 years ago. And by a miracle, the NBC guys asked me to come and do the commentary there. So I've been doing that for 5 years. Now, unfortunately, they've lost it to ESPN, who are doing a whole different scheme. And they're not using in-house people at all. They're just taking the Sky feed, as it happens, from the races.
So what was behind you then getting this book together also with in association? Because I think Andrew Marriott, who those in who know their racing will know that name as well. What was behind the idea behind putting it all down, and how much fun was it to put it all down and go through the files and go through the race reports and the photographs, which are fantastic?
Well, I mean, my wife has been saying you should write a book. She wanted me to write a book about my dad and his transmission, and of course I never did. And then she said, well, at least you should write a book about yourself. And that was about 20 years ago she started pushing on that. And then about 10 years ago I started doing it with a chap called Bob Varsha, who I was a commentator with in America. And writing wasn't my style, so I just dictated it, you know, into a little microphone or something, and then he would transcribe it. And then he and I kind of, we didn't fall out. I mean, we're still very, very close friends. But he was doing other stuff, and I went to NBC, and he stayed with Fox, so we didn't run into each other like we used to. And then, so I changed tactics and contacted Andrew, who I'd known since my very first years of racing. He was a very young reporter, and I was a very young racing driver. So I'd known Andrew for like 50 years. So he came on board and really knocked it into shape. And then I've been working with him on it for about 3 years. And then I had a publisher lined up in America, and that all fell apart. So Andrew found Evro Publishing in Britain, who had done a great book for Brian Redman. Oh, they'd done lots of great books, but they had done a great one for Brian Redman. And we worked with a chap called Mark Hughes, who's their sort of editor and layout guy, and he was absolutely fabulous to work with. And over the last couple of years, we put it together, and it just came out. So hitting the newsstands, as they say, as we speak.
Indeedy. And the book looks absolutely... The photographs are absolutely wonderful. I'm going to run out of time, David, which is a shame, because I could go on for this pretty much for most of the day. The book is called Hobbo, the Motor Racer, Motor Mouth, the autobiography of David Hobbs. If people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there a website? How can they find out about what you're up to and what you're doing next?
Well, I have to go to the Evro Publishing website. I, of course, in my own Luddite way, don't have a website, so so I'll have to call you and ask you what I'm doing. or Paul.
Super. Well, check out the book then on Evro Publishing. It will also be available as a download at the Talk Radio Europe, the virtual bookstore. I can't let you go, David, without a quick question. Formula One season started the last weekend. Who have you got in your sights for the championship this year then?
Well, from the look of last week's race, I don't see how Lewis Hamilton cannot win it. The Ferrari is right there. They just lost that race by a bit of a pit stop, a bit of a balls up in the pits, quite honestly. I mean, they should have won that race easy. Ferrari are getting there. And Red Bull, you know, Max Verstappen, I mean, if he hadn't made that mistake on his qualifying lap, he would have been on the front row. And if he'd got on the front row and made a good start, you know, who knows what might have happened. So I think Red Bull will be in there, but I don't think they'll be just quite good enough. So I suspect that our Lewis Hamilton will, and him and Vettel will be battling it out probably right through to the end of the year. But it's going to be interesting to see which of those two four-time world champions becomes a five-time world champion, because it's almost bound to be one of those two.
Indeed, we look forward to that. The book is called Hobbo, Motor Racer, Motor Math. It's out on now on Evra Publishing. David Hobbs, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Giles.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.